I try not to talk for too long, but I do feel that I want to just place the practice in a bit of context and also just quite briefly explain, or at least give you some sense of how to approach the practice. Yeah. I'll lead it through when we do it. I know some of you would have done this practice, some of you wouldn't. Perhaps I should start by thanking Tao Karunya for the shrine, and I think somewhere there, unfortunately I can't really make it out very well, the geometrical symbols for the elements are on the Buddha there. And they are actually quite often mapped onto the human body in some tantras or designs. You see the elements mapped onto the human body. Earth at the bottom and consciousness at the top. I want to start with a poem. And if you were here last Thursday night, it's the same one. For some reason, when I thought about six elements, it came to my mind. So this is a poem by the poet Robinson Jeffers, who was a sort of a mid-20th century American poet who was very concerned with the environment. A lot of his poems are about animals and the environment. And this is no exception. This is Carmel Point. And the Carmel Point's a place in California. The extraordinary patience of things. This beautiful place defaced by a crop of suburban houses. How beautiful when we first beheld it. Unbroken field of poppy and lupin, walled with clean cliffs. No intrusion but two or three horses pasturing, or a few milch cows rubbing their flanks on outcrop rockheads. Now the spoiler has come. Does it care? Not faintly. It has all time. It knows the people are a tide that will swell and in time ebb and all their works dissolve. Meanwhile, the image of the pristine beauty lives in the very grain of the granite, safe as the endless ocean that climbs our cliff. As for us, we must uncenter our minds from ourselves. We must dehumanize our views a little. We must unhumanize our views a little and become confident as the rock and ocean from which we are made. So I'm lucky enough probably five times a year to go on retreat to a place called Rivendell in Sussex, I think it is. And it's a lovely retreat centre, but around it a lot of farmland. I say farmland, but it's not agricultural farmland. Most of it is just pasture for animals. And when you go walking across the fields there, most of the fields, seemingly in a bit of a line, they have in the middle of a field a single, like one or two of these per field, oak tree. Now whether these oak trees have been left from when the fields were originally cleared, or whether they've been planted, I don't know. They're clearly mature oaks, so they're clearly some hundreds of years old, very beautiful trees. And because they've got no other trees around them, they're very, really catch your attention. And I often find myself sort of wondering at them and thinking, well, these trees, as we all know, have grown from this little acorn, a little seed, and they've grown into these magnificent, huge, living things. And of course, they've done so from the very beginning, the very inception in a way, when the acorn broke open. They've done so by gathering material from the world, you know. They've gathered nutriment from the soil, water. Once they've got leaves, they're gathering energy from the sun and from photosynthesis. And they're somehow combining these elements of the world and cell by cell building themselves up into these magnificent trees. You know? Now, we all know this, but it's nevertheless quite a sort of miraculous thing. And of course, we're no different from trees in this sense. Of course, in other senses, we are different. But in this sense, that everything that makes us up has, in some way or other, been gathered from the environment, from the world. Initially from our mother, through our mother's blood, and then when we're born, through milk and air, and then food and water, and so on and so forth. And like the tree, we become what we are. Yeah? In a way, of course, we say we are gathered from the world, but this isn't perhaps quite the right way of putting it, because, of course, the oak tree, or us, is no more or less part of the world than anything else. I mean, the world doesn't exist as some abstract thing. It exists because of all the phenomena. So perhaps more accurately, we should say that an oak tree is the world manifesting, the world or life manifesting as an oak tree. And we are the world or life manifesting as a human being. Yeah. So the world manifests in certain ways, and this, of course, is a continuous process. The other thing about an oak tree that's very obvious, and it's the same for a human being, but it's not quite so obvious. When you see an oak tree, these trees are there to, presumably they've been left there to provide shelter for the animals that graze in the fields. So they provide shelter from the sun or the rain for the sheep or the cows. But when we look at an oak tree, if you look at them carefully, you soon realise that they're more or less an entire sort of world within themselves, and they provide food and shelter for countless little insects, birds and so on. And of course the human body is a bit like this as well. We don't like to think about this too much, but evidently, I don't know if this is true, but it's probably got some truth in it. One of those things, they say we have more parasitic cells in us than we do actually human cells. Obviously, they must be smaller than the human cells, or we're just a big parasite, wouldn't we? But anyway, none of that. So anyway. But anyway, I think, so the sixth element practice is a way of, in a way, becoming more conscious of the fact that we are part of the world, that we are the world manifesting in a particular way for a particular, and relatively certain in geological, flash, you know, a relatively short time, the world manifests as us. In some ways, this is a remarkable thing, because whether it's a human being or an oak tree or anything else, I know this is again completely obvious, but nevertheless, when I think about it, I do find it quite remarkable. There's never going to be another human being the same as you. It doesn't matter how long this process goes on for. Millions, well, you know, well, I shouldn't say that, should I be cloning? Might end up with loads of, oh God. Anyway, let's forget about it. I don't believe it. I think even if you were cloned, you wouldn't be the same somehow, would you? Because what you gathered in would still be different. Okay, the genetic pattern or map would be the same, but actually, everything that you gathered in, the food you ate, the quality of the air and so on, that'd all be different. So actually, in your, of course, your social and psychological influence, so you wouldn't be the same, would you? Like identical twins are not at all identical, really, they're genetic. But anyway, but it's quite a remarkable thing to think of that. If you think about how many living things and also inanimate things there are in the world, none of them are exactly the same. And it puts us in quite, in a way I see this, and I think this is quite a common way that indigenous people understand life. They understand life as precious because it's never going to manifest in the same way again. It's always totally unique. So you as a human being, in a way, have a responsibility to express life as fully and as richly and as lovingly as you possibly can, because it's never going to be you again. That's never going to happen again. Yeah. So anyway, there's lots of different ways we can approach this practice, but however we approach it, it is within the Buddhist tradition what we call an insight practice. Now this division, we quite often come across this division for what's sometimes called samatha, or calming, or tranquility practices, concentration practices, in another class of practice sometimes called insight or vipassana practices. That is it's not an absolute division. And in fact, when we come to the element air, we will see that the mindfulness of breathing has a very strong insight element to it. And actually, if you wanted to strip this practice right down, you could just breathe. That would tell you everything essential about this practice, really, in some ways. Anyway, there's no strict, but roughly speaking, we sometimes talk about insight practice and samatha practices. And this particular practice is very definitely an insight practice. And again, there's lots of different ways we might talk about insight, but perhaps the most common is to talk about a practice that modifies, softens, opens our sense of who and what we are. So it changes it from a relatively tight, fixed idea of we experience ourselves as separate, perhaps quite, I quite like this image of it being tight, small. Sometimes, sometimes as Zen people, Suzuki Roshi just calls it small mind. So in his way, in his language, we're trying to move from what he calls small mind to big mind. We could talk about Furman, the teacher. He sometimes talks about the heart being in a clamp, like in a G clamp. The heart's sort of clamped down. And in this way of thinking, we're trying to open the heart. We're trying to loosen the heart. We're trying to the heart becomes unbounded. Yeah. So here the heart is a metaphor for consciousness again, or self, So we're trying to realize an ever-increasingly open, spontaneous, loving, connected way of being in the world. In a way, you could say we're trying to fully realize ourselves as belonging in and being part of the world. And what happens when we start to move towards this is that the world, strangely, even though the world is still a very, what can we say, it's a difficult place in lots of ways. It doesn't always seem to go the way we want it. Life isn't always easy. But actually, the more we unclench the heart, or we soften the sense of self, we open ourselves, the more it seems to me that we have the experience of the world becoming something that supports us, that holds us, which nourishes us. Of course, we're still going to get sick, we're still going to die, but actually instead of feeling it's us against the world, we feel like we are supported by the world. We feel that we're part of the world. And this is the sort of perhaps the emotional side of this movement. Yeah. And the sixth element practice is one of the primary ways, one of the primary practices that Buddhism has to try and enable us to move towards this more open, could even say enlightened state. Yeah. I think it's important to say that insight is an ongoing process. It's not a one-off event. Sometimes we have a very profound experience when we meditate, or maybe just in life in general, something happens. It seems to go very deeply, and this happens. But actually, there's no end to this process of opening into the world. There's no end to it. Yeah? And even if we have some quite strong experiences, it still should be seen very much as a process. It's not something that happens and that's it. Yeah? It's an ongoing. It's life. It's life itself. Yeah, it's just what life does. Yeah, it lives. It lives in the world, and we live in the world until we no longer do, as it were. Well, that's a good question. Anyway, we won't go there. I don't want to say too much because I'm aware there's another 6 or 7 evenings on this. So. What I don't say, I'm sure, will be filled in by others, or you'll get a different perspective. So the thing I want to emphasize about this practice is that it's a practice that, and I think this is in common with most insight practices, in order for them to work, they have to engage the imagination. Okay, for in order, this insight could be understood largely as an act of imagination. Now, this is quite a difficult thing for me to say because it's easy to misunderstand what I mean by this. It's not an act of fantasy. Yeah, so I'm making a distinction between fantasy and imagination. In this sense, at least, fantasy is usually driven by the ego. So when we think, wouldn't it be nice if I won the lottery? And then we think, well, if I won 5 million, I should give 1 million to my mum, 1 million to my brother. That'd leave me a couple. Well, maybe I need 6 million, and I should do it. You know, it just escalates, doesn't it? Or wouldn't it be nice if I was famous, you know, if I, whatever. You know the sort of thing, you can feel it's driven by the ego. It's ego-driven. So this is what we call fantasy. And of course we can have a fantasy about insight or a fantasy about enlightenment, not so uncommon. But in contrast, the imaginal faculty, usually understood as coming from the heart, this is the European and also the Middle Eastern, and in a way also the Eastern tradition, the imagination is a function of the heart. So it's immediately lower down. It's in this sort of second brain. Sometimes people think about these three basic psychic centres, don't they? A kind of psychic centre, Nahara, or the Dhatien, or low in the body, down in what would be the earth element region, and a bit up into the water element, if we are mapping the elements onto the body. And this is... This tends to be about our basic instincts and drives, and our basic sense of belonging or isolation is down there. And we move up to the heart, and the heart is associated with love, fire. Of course, it's also associated with hate, jealousy. It's associated with quite particular and more differentiated but very powerful emotions. So the imagination is associated with the heart. The imagination comes into play when we dream. So when we dream, it's not driven by the ego. We do have a dream ego. So there's usually a character in the dream that we identify with. But usually that character he or she feels like they're in the dream. So this is a difference. Imagination has us rather than we having it. So when we dream, we feel like we're inside of the dream, don't we? So the imagination is the same thing. So this is why very often artists, poets, painters feel that invoke the idea of a muse. They feel like this force, and of course this is a little bit like what we're talking about as the sixth element. Like it comes in from outside. It's more or less like the psychic equivalent of life itself. It comes in from outside of us. Often, oddly enough, in monotheistic traditions, it tends to come in from above, but in a lot of indigenous and Greeks, and all, it usually comes up from below. So it's more like a spring comes up from below, and even this is the case with things like the Delphi Oracle and things like this. It comes up and enters us from below. But however it gets in, it doesn't really matter. I quite like the idea of it coming up from below rather than from above. But anyway, that's just me. So anyway, we need to use the imagination. I say, or we need to allow the imagination to work on us. And the imagination, as far as meditation goes, should be, as far as possible, connected with, associated with, or arising from an actual physical felt experience. So the meditation is not so much intellectual, although this can support the meditation, but it's not essentially an intellectual, analytical, or scientific. Yeah, it's more that we're trying to experience directly these elements in the body. So we don't have to take them totally literally. So the six elements are earth, associated with the root, perhaps associated, then water, perhaps associated, we're mapping it onto the body, the digestive. Fire, associated perhaps with the heart. Air, associated with the throat. Space, brow, and consciousness, crown. Well, don't worry about that too much. That's not really relevant in a way, although I think it's quite interesting. But what we're trying to find them as felt experiences in the body, okay? And of course you can use your intellectual, conceptual mind to try and help you do that. But you're trying to find them. So when we talk about earth, we're not, as I say, we're not taking it totally literally, like the earth in your garden or something. But we're really talking about the quality, or we're talking as much about the quality. What is the quality of earth? So the quality of earth is solidity. It's got a certain resistance to it. It's also, we can think about it emotionally. We use these terms emotionally, don't we? We say someone's earthy, or we say someone's a bit wet, or we say, well, they've got a fiery temper, or they're an airhead. You know, we use all of these elements to describe emotion as well, or a feeling we have, and say, well, he's a bit slimy, or whatever. You know, you can all, there's loads of them, aren't there? Like hothead, or, you know, whatever. So these elements is also, and they've all also got potentially a positive and a negative side. Or so if you've got too much earth, you can be a bit sort of slovenly, perhaps a bit dense. You know, so he's a bit dense. I mean, that's another kind of material world, isn't it? So earth can be associated with confidence, with strength, with stability, with depth, but it also might be associated with stuckness, or, you know, you can use your own imagination. And one of the ways you could think about this meditation is that this is a little bit of a tangent here. In a way, you want all of these elements. You want to be aware of all of these elements, because it's all of these elements are coming together, just like all those things have to come together to create this oak tree. All these elements come together to create you. And perhaps psychically, you could say you want access to all these elements, potentially. So, you know, water offers you fluidity, flow, you know, and so on and so on, you know. Fire offers you passion, you know. So in this way, it's also an imaginative, associative practice. You can't do it wrong or right. It's not something you do right or wrong. Yeah, you just try and enjoy it, and don't try and hold too tight to it. And when I lead it through for you. But don't take too much notice of what I'm saying. Yeah? But, having said all that, try and keep it as simple as possible. Try and stay try and keep it embodied in some way. Try and keep it embodied in some way. So we will try and start off as far as possible. It gets a little bit more difficult when we get to space and consciousness. But up to that point, there's always quite a tangible, physical reference that you can come back to if you start getting a bit heady. Yeah, if you start getting too speculative. Come back to the physicality of it, of the element, yeah? So it's got a very simple structure in a way. Sometimes it's done more or less formulaically. Actually, the formula, which I haven't memorized, so I don't know, that we've got from Sangharakshita, our teacher, is rather nice, but as I said, I don't quite recall it. But perhaps somewhere along the line, in the preceding weeks, you'll get that version, yeah. But basically, you try and feel into, imagine, so. By imagining, I mean feeling into, really. Yeah, sensing. Moving towards. The imagination, in this sense, moves us towards direct experience. It doesn't move us towards abstraction. So if you're doing something that's moving you to more and more abstract, that's not what I mean by imagination. That becomes fantasy. So we're trying to move towards a more embodied felt sense. Anyway, we imagine the element in us, we imagine the element outside of us, we then reflect that it's the same element, and then we reflect something along the lines that, well, we don't own that element, it's on loan, or we borrowed it. I don't really like that, because that kind of implies that we're somehow not part of the world. I mean, it's no more or less, there's not a world out here in us, so it's, in a way it's no more or less ours than anything else, but it is only temporarily making up this thing we call ourselves. And as we go through the elements, you'll see the time that we keep hold of that element diminishes. So when we start with Earth, we have it for a reasonably long time, in the sense that I know we eat, and I know only too well at the moment, but you know, we eat and it passes through us, but that food makes up bones and cells, and I think it's 7 years, isn't it, that they get replaced, roughly. Yeah. So we have some of that earth element for about 7 years, but as we go up through the elements, so when we get to breath, we can feel that we just have it for a few seconds. And when we get to consciousness, well, consciousness is a bit of a more difficult, but if we're talking about the content of consciousness, of course, you know, they're just fleeting, aren't they? They're there for a few seconds. You know? Anyway, enough said. I'm going on a bit. Enough said. We'll just do the practice, see how we get on. And as I say, don't worry about doing it right. If you haven't done it before, just relax and try and enjoy it. I'm gonna anchor it. This isn't normally done, I don't think. But it is my thing. I'm gonna kind of anchor it to the breath. So this isn't the conventional way of doing the practice, but I'm doing this because normally this practice would be done after a samatha practice, after a calming practice. And so what we're going to do is we're going to keep the breath in mind. We're going to start with the breath and then we're going to keep it in mind as we go through. So this may be, hopefully, help to keep it more embodied, yeah? Keep it more embodied and less just an idea. Nothing wrong with an idea. Don't get me wrong, ideas are very useful in these sort of practices, but they're just at the beginning in a way.